This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll talk about AIDS and the flu. But first, climate change. Is the Kyoto Protocol, the international treaty designed to limit greenhouse gas emissions, is Kyoto dead? There's word from Russia that it may not ratify the treaty. And if that's true, the Kyoto Protocol won't go into effect, even though 120 other countries, the U.S. not among them, have ratified it. This hour, we'll talk about the future of international climate change policy after Kyoto. Do we really need the agreement to spur real change? Is it too late to slow the warming that's already underway? A new study out this week in the journal Science makes predictions for the rate of warming over the next 100 years, and the authors say that even if we do take steps to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, it may be too late to stop some of the changes that such warming will bring. We'll talk about it, and if you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com for more information. Let me introduce my guests. Aline Clausen is the president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change in Arlington, Virginia. She joined us today by phone from Northern Virginia. She's about to leave for Milan for the UN climate change meeting. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Tom Carl is the director of the National Climatic Data Center at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Asheville, North Carolina. He joined us today from his office there. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you, Ira.
Thank you. Kevin Trenberth is a senior scientist and the head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder. That's NCAR in Boulder, Colorado. He joined us today from his office there. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Ira, and hi, Tom and Eileen.
Well, let me begin by asking you, Eileen, what is the latest word on that Russian participation in the Kyoto Protocol?
Well, honestly, it's really hard to tell. There have been statements saying that Russia wouldn't ratify from the Russians. There have been statements from the Russians saying that they will ratify. And then there have been statements from the Russians, in all cases government, saying we're going to try really hard, although it's going to be difficult. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, your guess is probably as good as mine.
And when would we know if they would say anything?
Well, I mean, you have elections to the Duma this weekend, and Putin himself will be facing an election in the winter. I think it's in February. So my guess is we won't really know until the spring of next year.
And why this word that the Russians might not sign on to the agreement? What would their reasoning be?
Well, I think the Russians were first very interested in the Kyoto Protocol and signed it when they thought the United States would also be ratifying it and would buy lots of credits from Russia for the emissions that they would not be generating. But with the United States out of the picture, it looks a little less lucrative from their point of view. And so it's also hard to tell whether this is just a way to see if they can up the price or whether it's a legitimate concern that if they grow their economy a great deal, it's going to be hard to keep emissions low.
If this does spell the death knell for Kyoto, does that mean that we're at a dead end about global warming or worldwide cooperation?
No, I really don't think so, because I think you have to look at what Kyoto has really done. And you can first look to Europe, where a lot of countries are moving forward, maybe some not as fast as we would all like, but many are moving forward. There is an emissions trading system for Europe as a whole. The British have a long-term energy policy that takes climate change into account. So there's a lot of activity in Europe. There's also a lot of activity here at the state level. Many states now have renewable portfolio standards. Some states have regulations to curb emissions from utilities. There's a lot more interest in the United States in regional approaches. And we even had a bill that was voted on in the Senate for the very first time that would reduce emissions. And while it lost, it's the Lieberman-McCain bill, it actually got 43 positive votes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's good, too.
It's interesting that this word from Russia, or the possibility that the Kyoto Treaty would not come to pass, because of the article the journal Science has at the December 5th issue with my two guests, my other guests who are authors. Let me turn to them, because it seems to me this is the most directly worded conclusion I've seen in print in a while about global warming. Let me just read from the abstract. It says, modern climate change is dominated by human influences which are now large enough to exceed the bounds of natural variability. and the main source of global climate change is human-induced changes in atmospheric composition. Kevin Trenberth, no bones about it in that summary.
I'll take it as a positive thing that you mm-hmm. think it is so clear. I think this is very clear that climate change is happening. We also say, however, that there's a lot of uncertainties to the nature of the change, and that there's a lot of information gaps that inhibit our actions that might flow from this.
Mm-hmm. Tom Carlin, you say the biggest culprit is human-induced global warming, is our energy use, correct?
Well, that's right. It's very clear that carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere have increased significantly since the Industrial Revolution, about 31%. This isn't the only factor that contributes to global climate change. As Kevin alluded to, there's other uncertainties. We have other emissions into the atmosphere, and things like aerosols, these tiny particles you frequently see in haze, and they affect climate. And all these things have to be factored in, and they do lead to some uncertainties about the rate of change we might expect, say, over the next 100 years. Part of the uncertainty in this rate of change is due to uncertain emissions, and this is what Eileen was referring to. But the other part is our uncertain understanding of the science. And one of the things that we've tried to do in this article is at least articulate in a fashion that we probably would be irresponsible if we had the capability of putting a smoke detector in a house and there was a potential for the fire. We'd certainly want the smoke detector in the house to alert us to any unusual event. And the same thing with a global observing system that we feel is really important to try and narrow down these uncertainties. We think we need to do a much better job in organizing the global community and putting together a surface-based and space-based observing system that can really track and alert us to anything that might be happening out of the ordinary that we might not have expected, because there are a lot of uncertainties here still.
So you want to watch the progression of this.
Exactly, because we're not like chemists that we can actually go into a laboratory and run of an experiment. The global environment is our experiment. Unfortunately, it's a major effort both internationally in terms of coordination to put up these measurements, and it's a major investment as well.
What's interesting also about your article is that you say that there's really no turning back the clock now. I'll quote you, "We are venturing into the unknown with climate, and its associated impacts could be quite disruptive."
Yes, there's clearly in the range of possibilities things that we don't quite completely understand. A lot of discussion in the scientific literature about the stability of the West Antarctic ice sheet. We don't know enough about the characteristics of that ice sheet to know just how stable or unstable it may be. Right now, most of the thinking is that it's not going to be an issue in the next 10 to 20 years. But again, how do you want to venture out in these probabilities in terms of you want to be 99% sure, 90% sure, or it's still uncertain.
Eileen Klassen, I know you're going to catch a plane to go to Milan for the UN climate change meeting. Are these people? Is this the kind of study you can take with you and say, look, things are moving along, we need to take some action? Or are you already preaching to the converted in Milan?
Well, actually, there's a mix of people in Milan. I think many people are the converted, but not all. And I think this study actually is very, very helpful because it does point to some of the certainties as well as to some of the uncertainties. And from our point of view, uncertainty is actually a reason to act, because it could be uncertain and turn out worse than we think. So I'm actually really pleased about the study, and I think it'll get a very good hearing in Milan.
Mm-hmm. Tom or Kevin, you project the rate of future climate change may vary widely, anywhere from 3 to almost 9 degrees Fahrenheit. That's really a huge, huge difference. It can't be more precise than that, can you?
Well, the 3 to 9, about half of that uncertainty is due to uncertain models that we have. About half of it is due to the uncertainty in the emissions, what will happen to the economy and the energy that's actually used, and whether or not things like Kyoto are actually adopted. And so that's where the uncertainty comes from. But one of the things that we have clearly said here is that this is happening and it's going to continue to happen and we're going to have to deal with it. This is, you know, I think in many ways it's actually worse than something like the deficit in the economy. This is a burden on our grandchildren and their grandchildren into the future.
Mm-hmm. And this is something they have no choice in either about what they're going to inherit.
That's correct. I mean, there's some really convincing evidence going on. We have a satellite called Topex Poseidon and a follow-on satellite called Jason, which is measuring the surface of the sea. And over the last 10 years, sea level has risen an inch and a quarter. That's a very
wow.
substantial number. And the main we can also account for that. Nearly all of it can actually be accounted for by the observations of warming going on within the ocean. That we know also that glaciers are melting and adding extra mass to the ocean, and so that's an extra contribution, but it turns out that is partly canceled out by the fact that there's more storage of water on land in reservoirs and through irrigation, through watering soils and so on. But this is a global number, and it's quite a large number. It's much larger than the historical record indicates. We estimate about 6 inches rise over the last 100 years. But this is a real sign that global warming is happening.
And this is just from the water heating up. The ocean is just naturally expanding as water does when it warms up.
That's correct.
Wow. And this could go on. Will it accelerate or will it continue at a linear pace?
Well, as we say in the article, one of the sorts of things that can lead to acceleration is the melting of ice. And we know that ice in the Arctic has been at record low levels the last 2 years, the last two summers.
Yeah.
And this means that the ocean is much darker in the high latitudes. And so that leads to a positive feedback. It means that more solar radiation is absorbed. And this is the sort of thing that mm-hmm. can begin to run away and amplify things at high latitudes.
Kevin Trenberth, before we let Eileen Claussen go, any message you would like her to take to the policymakers at the UN meeting?
Well, you know, I was listening to, I've seen the various reports, and one of the rather cynical views of this is that Russia is simply trying to play off Europe versus the United States and seeing what kind of a deal it can get. I wonder if she could comment on that.
I think it's very possible, because, of course, the United States has decided to withdraw from Kyoto, and the administration is focusing on sort of long-term research, but nothing in the short term. And there's certainly some pressure on Russia to join the United States, just as the Europeans are really interested in having Russia ratify so that the Kyoto Protocol can go into effect. So it could be that kind of geopolitics, as well as just money issues.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to let you go, Eileen. I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. Do you know if and when there's a schedule for some conclusion or some we'll know what happened in that meeting in Milan?
Well, it goes through next week, but I have to say there aren't going to be any serious conclusions because there are only some minor technical issues that have to be resolved. I think the meeting is important because it is the first time we're going to have a lot of discussion about what happens beyond Kyoto. Hmm. Either if it goes into effect, what happens next, or if it doesn't go into effect, what do we do instead? So I think it will be significant.
All right. Thank you, Eileen. Eileen Claussen, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, speaking with us from Arlington, Virginia. We're going to come back and talk more with Kevin Trenberth and Tom Carl about global warming, talk about their study in Science, the journal Science, very interesting conclusions. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about global climate change, what comes after the Kyoto Agreement and possible alternatives to it, with my guest Kevin Trenberth, senior scientist and head of the Climate Analysis Section at NCAR in Boulder, Colorado. Tom Carl, director of the National Climate Data Center at NOAA in Asheville, North Carolina. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two. Thor in Philly. Hi, Thor.
Yes, Ira. Hi, yes.
Fine.
My question is really what the balance of equation looks like in terms of the overall heat retention from these greenhouse gases compared to some of the models that will show a significant amount of reflection due to the albedo from the clouds or, as we're getting in the northeast today, a significant amount of snow. So really, where is the balance of equation in terms of heat gain versus heat loss, and how much of a percent change do these greenhouse gases represent?
Tom Carl, can you answer that?
Yeah, I think it would be appropriate to talk a little bit about the feedbacks represented in the model and where our source of uncertainty is. If you just look at carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, for example, that would have an impact of, say, a unity of one. Now, if you look at these feedback effects like cloud cover, there is where our biggest uncertainty is. They can actually go to cooling, a slight cooling, so opposite direction of increase in greenhouse gases, to as much as doubling the effect of just greenhouse gases alone. So clouds themselves, where they form, whether they're higher or lower, all have additional uncertainties, and this is leading to this uncertain range. Other aspects that were mentioned, the snow albedo feedback, that's another important feedback, but not as important as things like water vapor feedback. Not only when you add carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you evaporate more water from the surface, that puts more moisture into the atmosphere, and water vapor actually is the most dominant greenhouse gas. That actually is an enhancement, and it multiplies this effect by as much as a factor between 1 and 2. So these feedback effects are what leads to this uncertainty. I think that's what the caller was alluding to.
Mark in Santa Cruz. Hi, Mark. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
I'm wondering if the melting of the ice caps can affect the salinity of the northern oceans, how that affects current, and if there's a significant effect on weather patterns.
Yeah, we've heard of a theory where the Gulf Stream might be affected so that it no longer gets as far as Europe because of the salinity difference, and Europe would go into a freeze instead of a warming period. Kevin, Tom, any thoughts on that?
Yes, this relates to when ice sheets melt, in particular, and land ice, that does put fresh water into the ocean. Fresh water is not as dense as salt water, and so this does relate to what is referred to as the thermohaline circulation. There are predictions from climate models, many climate models, that indicate the thermohaline circulation may slow down. This means that things like the Gulf Stream and the heat transports by the ocean up towards Europe and the North Atlantic, for instance, are slowed down, and it could cause some regional cooling relative to the overall warming that's otherwise going on in that part of the world. It doesn't necessarily mean that that part of the world cools, but it does mean that there's regional climate change that complicates things considerably.
All right. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. You spoke a bit before about needing to monitor the Earth from a satellite better. Tell us more about what you think that should comprise.
Well, Ira, I could take a crack at that one. One of the things that we are making some good progress, we have gotten together internationally saying we, all the nations of the world, and have focused on developing a global climate observing system. And to date, what I think we have to show, we've been able to evaluate where we are today. We've developed some principles that were actually adopted at the Conference of the Parties, the fourth Conference of the Parties in Bonn a number of years ago. But the real issue now is putting some teeth behind those principles and ensuring they get implemented. And that's going to take some discipline, because what we've relied on over these past number of years is a collection of observing systems that have been primarily designed and have served a very useful purpose for weather prediction. And now we're trying to measure changes that are subtle, and they're complicated by this large day-to-day, week-to-week weather variability. So we're trying to bring the standard of observing systems from both space, ships, surface stations, up to a much higher level.
What do you say to the people who still are not convinced? They see stories about ice. Some parts of Antarctica have more ice than they had before. They see stories about the southern hemisphere not warming up as much as the northern hemisphere, all kinds of stories. They're not convinced that global warming is real.
It's very easy to point to things going on, and a lot of these are related to weather. You know, last winter is a good example where it was rather cold and snowy in the eastern parts of the United States, but it was record warmth in the western parts of the United States, and up in Alaska, glaciers were melting, and the snowpack was at below normal levels. And so it is important to get a global perspective on things, and this is one of the things that satellites does for us very well. The problem with satellites is that they keep changing. They only last about 5 years, and then we have to replace them with another one, and it's in a different orbit with a different instrument. And relating what those measurements are to the previous instrument is one of the difficulties in tracking exactly what's going on. And so it has to be coupled with a very good ground-based so-called in-situ network of observations in order to be able to fully track exactly what's going on.
Ira, this, if I could just make a comment, this is sort of like a, you know, if you were in school and you're taking a test, and you get 100 questions, you know, you got to get 90 or above to get an A, and that's a good analogy, I think, to where we are today, because sometimes you might not get it right, or you may see some conflicting signs, and I think what scientists have tried to do is collectively assemble as much information as they can to see if it makes a consistent picture. And I don't think anyone would agree every piece of those 100 facets all makes sense. But I think what we're saying is, you know, we're at the level now where 90 out of the 100 do, and that's pretty good to get a score of A.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, I wish you luck. And is there any way for us to predict what steps? Next time we'll have you come back and talk about what we might expect, perhaps, if your predictions are true.
Well, we'd love to. From the standpoint, we think there are some things that are uncertain on the local level, but there are some issues in terms of changing extremes of precip and changes of record heat and cold. That
are we seeing those already?
Yes, we are seeing in some areas, not all areas, but for example, with changes in extreme precipitation, we're fairly consistent from model to model showing that. And in this paper, we showed empirically, even if you don't change precipitation amounts, as temperatures warm, we do get many more events in the heavy and extreme category than we might otherwise.
One more question for you. We keep hearing about going, you know, toward a hydrogen economy and taking hydrogen out of coal, which we have a lot of, and then sequestering the carbon dioxide out of it back into the ground. Can we suck any of the CO2 back in? Is it just too big a problem?
Once it's out there, it's extremely difficult, and of course you have to use energy to be able to do that, and so it's partly self-defeating. And this is one of the difficulties with climate change. The fact that we've put the stuff into the atmosphere and it has a long lifetime, carbon dioxide has a lifetime of order, 100 years, means that we have to live with the consequences. It's not as easy a problem in that regard as the deficit, because we can't reverse what we've already done. It's certainly in our interest, I think, in that regard, to be prudent and try and slow down the rate of emissions into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. All right, gentlemen, I thank you very much for joining us. Tom Carl, director of the National Climatic Data Center at NOAA in Nashville, North Carolina, and Kevin Trenberth, who is senior scientist and head of the climate analysis section at NCAR in Boulder, Colorado. Thank you both.
Thanks, Larry.
Nice
talking to you.
And we're talking about the article in Science this week about climate change.